Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I think that there is always the danger that when you introduce any tech into the bedroom, then that's the thin end of the wedge for being tempted for that tech usage to escalate into areas which are not particularly conducive for sleep.
Well, we've all been.
Hello and welcome to It's Complicated with me, Tanya Goodin, the podcast to help you untangle your relationship with your phone.
Because we've all been pushed around.
This is a podcast about learning to live healthily and happily with technology and the digital world, and understanding why sometimes it's so hard to do. Because if we learn how to step away from our phones more, we'll be learning how to step in more to our lives, improving our relationships, our work, and our health.
Because we've all been swept away, yeah.
I'm your host, Tanya Goodin, author and founder of digital wellbeing movement Time to Log Off. Each week I'll be asking a new guest what they've learned about the relationship with the tiny tyrant in their pocket, their smartphone. This week we have a very long overdue episode on sleep, because sleep and screens, I would say, is the number one thing that people ask me about when I have any kind of conversation about our tech habits. So very appropriate that we should devote an entire episode to it today. So I'm talking to Dr. Guy Leschener, who is consultant neurologist and clinical lead for the Sleep Disorder Centre at Guy's Hospital in London, one of Europe's largest sleep units. And we had a very wide-ranging conversation about all aspects of sleep, really, from why do we sleep, the patterns of our sleep, has it changed over time, what kind of thing has affected the way and the patterns in which we sleep, the difference between night owls and larks. Are there any qualitative differences between people who have different sleep patterns? And getting right to the nub of things, what's the truth about sleep and screens? Do those two mix? And other aspects of technology and screens, technology and sleep, what about sleep trackers? Are they helpful? Are they harmful? So I think this episode is going to answer all your questions about tech and sleep. And hopefully at the end of it, we'll all be prepared to get a really good night's sleep. So I hope you enjoy it. So Guy, welcome to It's Complicated.
Thank you very much for having me, Tanya.
I was just looking back through our episodes and we're on the fourth series now, and I can't believe it's taken me this long to have an episode devoted to sleep, because it's the one thing everybody asks me about. When I go and give talks, you know, either in the workplace or in schools, everybody wants to know about the relationship between our screen habits, specifically in sleep.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd sort of kick off with, a really easy and straightforward question for you, Guy, which is, how much sleep do we really need?
I thought you said easy and straightforward, Tanya.
There was irony in my voice.
Yes, I think that's a really difficult question to answer. Everybody expects people to trot out the kind of 7 to 8 or 8.5 hours. And I think that quantity of sleep is probably a good guide point. But we know that there is huge variability between individuals as to how much sleep they require. And it is largely defined by our age, in that our sleep requirement changes dramatically through our lives. But it's also related to genetics, in that we know that there are genetic variants that influence how much sleep we actually need. There are genetic variants that result in really quite dramatic short sleep times. So I look after a couple of families, for example, in whom many people within the family can only sleep for about 4 or 5 hours and have no obvious negative consequences to that. Equally, there are some genetic variants that cause people to have a longer sleep requirement, sometimes 9, even 10 hours.
I think that's me.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of people. But I think that the other thing is that many people who have a long sleep requirement actually have a long sleep requirement because they have some sort of problem with their sleep, either in terms of sleep quality or something else that is disrupting their sleep, like medications or other illnesses.
So why is sleeping important? I mean, apart from the fact that we all feel rubbish when we haven't had a good night's sleep.
You're getting all the straightforward questions out of the
way,
aren't you?
Yeah, all the really easy, quick wins up front.
Yeah.
Why do we sleep?
Why do we sleep?
In the first place, yes.
Well, I think the short answer is we still don't fully know. The longer answer is there is more than one answer to that question, because sleep has evolved over millions of years. Really, we know that even when one looks at single-celled organisms, or you take a single cell out of your body and stick it in a Petri dish, the circadian rhythm, that is the 24-hour cycle, is hardwired into our genes. And it's likely that that circadian rhythm has evolved from the initial universal ancestor of all life forms on Earth.
So, and do all animals sleep? There are no examples anywhere of animals that don't sleep.
They all exhibit behavior that is consistent with something akin to sleep. And, you know, even if you look at plants, there are genes that are regulated on a 24-hour cycle. So The reason why I say this is it's likely that over millions of years, with evolutionary pressure, actually sleep has become an opportunity for more complicated organisms like humans, mammals, generally those animals that are more complex on a biological basis, to shoehorn a number of regulatory functions into sleep. And if one looks at human beings, we now know that essentially sleep is fundamental to every biological process in our lives. Every aspect of our waking lives is influenced by our sleep. So anything from mental health, memory, emotional regulation, to blood pressure, appetite, healing, the immune system, our brain health, so whether or not we are likely to have Alzheimer's disease in the future, a whole range of physiological parameters are regulated by sleep. So this is why I said it's not a very short answer.
But I guess that's why sleep deprivation is such an effective form of torture, isn't it? I mean, it's one of the kind of, I hesitate to say traditional forms of torture, but it's a kind of accepted way of, you know, breaking somebody down if you deprive them of sleep.
Yeah. I mean, you can go longer without food than you can go without sleep. Mm. You know, this is absolutely fundamental to the maintenance of our biological integrity. And, you know, when it comes to things like torture, one of the things that sleep deprivation is very good at is causing disruption of normal functioning of the brain. So both from an emotional perspective, but also from a cognitive perspective, which is why people, you know, tend to hallucinate, for example, if they are sleep deprived for too long. It's a very good way of breaking somebody.
I'm not sure if it was in one of your books or somewhere else I read about the fact that actually we used to sleep
in a slightly different way. I think I'm right in saying a few hundred years ago that our sleep used to be broken in the early hours of the morning and we had something called a little sleep. Is that right?
Yes. Well, that wasn't in one of my books. And the reason it wasn't one of my books is because it remains a somewhat controversial area as to what right. the evidence for that is. I mean, I think there are some people who say that historically there was a tendency to have two sleeps, something called biphasic sleep, whereby people would go to bed, sleep for a few hours, then get up in the middle of the night, do something, and then go back yeah. to bed. But if you look at pre-industrialized societies, if you look at, for example, societies now where they don't have electricity, we don't exhibit that pattern of sleep. So it remains a somewhat controversial area.
Yeah, I suppose the reason I brought it up was just trying to see if there had been changes over time in the way that we sleep or the pattern that we sleep in. I guess one link is with, as you say, artificial light.
Yes.
That, you know, in societies and parts of the world where we have, you know, we've got access to electricity, we're not just sleeping when the sun sets. Yes. But is that the main difference, do you think, over the last kind of few hundred years?
Well, I think even that is relatively complicated because, of course, you know, 100 years ago, the vast majority of us were sleeping on the floor on sacks stuffed with straw in unheated houses. Whereas now, of course, most of us are in, you know, very nice, comfortable beds in nice, comfortable bedrooms. So I think undoubtedly there are shifts in terms of our society when it comes to circadian rhythm. And what I mean by that is that, you know, obviously in pre-industrialized societies, people would tend to get up with the sunlight, with dawn. Whereas now, because we are able to do other things in the evening when it's dark outside, that has probably shifted our internal biological clock backward a little bit. So we tend to go to sleep much later than we otherwise would.
You actually had a case study in your book, didn't you, of that the secret world of sleep, of a disrupted circadian rhythm disorder, I think was with a young boy.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
Right? Was it Vincent?
Yeah, Vincent, that's correct. Yeah. So Vincent is a young man who actually reset his body clock so that it was running on a 25-hour rather than a 24-hour rhythm. So every day he would go to bed 1 hour later and wake up 1 hour later, which was fine for about 1 week of the month. But for the rest of the time, he was completely out of sync with the world. I think this, what we term a non-24-hour rhythm disorder, is actually quite rare in people. It's occasionally seen in people who are completely blind because they then lose one of the major drivers for regulation of your circadian rhythm, which is external light. But in people who are sighted, it's actually incredibly rare. But what's not rare is what's termed delayed sleep phase syndrome, where people tend to go to bed very, very late and wake up very late. So these are people who are termed extreme night owls. That shift of our body clock is something that we very frequently see in teenagehood. So teenagers will often tend to go to bed very late and want to wake up very late. Now, whether they're allowed to wake up very late is a different matter because it's often as a result of it's limited as a result of the fact that they have to get up to go to school or get up to go to work. But there are some individuals out there who, separate from that sort of teenage shift, become extreme night owls and so will often be unable to sleep before 4 or 5 in the morning and then will want to wake up in the early afternoon. Some of that is related to our behavior and some of that is related to our genetics. So once again, we know that our circadian rhythm is to some extent defined by our genes. There are genes that influence whether or not we're morning larks, so have a tendency to want to wake up very early and go to bed very early, or are night owls. But there are things in what we do on a day-to-day basis that also have a very strong influence. And light, coming back to your point about current society, is one of the very potent drivers for a shift in our biological rhythms.
So that difference between larks and night owls, there's no connection between that and IQ. Is what I'm hoping you're going to say, because I've always been made to feel a complete sloth by people who say they only need 4 hours sleep or they're up at, you know, 5 a.m. in the morning. I'm not one of those people. I'm definitely a night owl.
I don't think you have to worry about your IQ.
Or productivity. There's a real kind of trend at the moment to talking about, you know, getting up very early in the morning. And if you can get an extra 2 hours before everybody else wakes up, you're going to be more productive, more successful. For those of us who are night owls, that just feels like a stick, another stick to beat us with.
Well, I think it's all about what the demands of society around you are in relation to your own circadian rhythm. So if there is nothing stopping you from getting up at 11 and going to sleep at 2, then clearly you're not going to be any more sleep deprived than anybody else. And the major factors are going to be whether or not you can make phone calls during the day, whether or not you can have time to yourself. And there is an argument for saying, well, actually, if you're on a slightly different rhythm to everybody else, then you actually have some undisturbed time at either end of the day.
So you mentioned just before we got into that kind of off tracks, like we were talking about adolescents and their different kind of sleep requirements. And actually, I've been thinking a lot about this chicken and egg about screens in bedrooms, which is the kind of thorny issue that I get asked about everywhere I go. And there's one really big piece of research from Cardiff University, which looked at adolescents between years 7 and 11. About 80,000 of them, and asked them the last time they were on screens at night before they went to bed. And about 10% of them said the last time they were on screens was 2 a.m. So there's one school of thought that says, well, obviously it's the screen that's hyperstimulating, interfering with the melatonin, producing bursts of dopamine, making life so exciting that they can't put them down. Then there's the other school, I imagine, that would say, actually, adolescents have always been like that. They've always been awake at 2 o'clock in the morning, or, you know, a large proportion of them have been. So, slightly rambling question. What's your view on the whole kind of screens in bedrooms, teenagers and sleep deprivation issue?
It's a bit of a vicious cycle, I think. And, you know, your point about chicken and egg very much illustrates that. So if you have a tendency towards going to bed a little bit late and waking up a little bit late, and you then start doing something that does two things. It, first of all, exposes you to bright light. And we know that bright light, particularly blue light, has an impact on the your brain secretion of melatonin. Melatonin is the hormone that is produced by a gland in your brain called pineal gland, which is a really important regulator of your biological rhythm, of your internal body clock. So you're suppressing your natural melatonin, then you're likely to be making that problem worse. But in addition, and you alluded to this in your reference to dopamine hits, you're essentially, you know, if you are online, you know, particularly social media or things like that, then that also provides significant mental stimulation. And that is in itself going to make it more difficult for you to drift off to sleep. So essentially, you probably have a sizable proportion of young people who have a slightly delayed phase. And by that, I mean that they are their body clock is pushed back a little bit, but then they're doing lots of things in bed or in the evening that is going to make that much worse. Because it is a combination of underlying biology and also behavior as well.
Yeah. And if they're last on screens at 2 a.m. and then they have to get up at 7 a.m. for school or even earlier than that, then we're back in that conversation about sleep deprivation again, aren't we?
Exactly.
That actually it's not a good idea generally because it's stopping them sleeping.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
So what, talking about that blue light and melatonin, I get asked a lot about yellow light filters, so glasses that you can get and night shift you can enable on your phone. Have you seen any evidence that that makes any difference?
Well, I think that the first thing to say is that a lot of the studies that have been done look at melatonin secretion rather than a direct translation into sleep. And there does remain some controversy within the field as to how important the light issue is compared to how important the mental stimulation issue is. What we certainly know is that these many of these tools that are used to apparently reduce the amount of blue light in what we're looking at, so things like night shift mode, and there are a couple of other apps, actually intrinsically make very little difference to the degree of suppression of your melatonin. And actually what you need to be doing is you need to be reducing the contrast of the device that you're looking at right down.
When you say contrast, you mean
the brightness
to grayscale, or just the brightness? Okay.
The brightness. Yeah. So in addition to any apparent blue light reduction app, you also need to be reducing the brightness of your screen right down. Okay. But there is a separate argument about whether it is the light or whether it's the mental stimulation that is most important in terms of the deleterious consequences on sleep. Yeah. And no yellow glasses, no app, no reduction of brightness is going to get away from the fact that what you're doing is you're spending an awful lot of time in bed, which you should associate with being asleep, doing something very active and very stimulating.
It's really difficult to know how we could ever separate those two to be able to work out the different impact. You know, if you're looking at light on a screen versus stimulation, I would think an experiment to how you design an experiment to take away the stimulation but still have the light, or vice versa, would be quite hard.
Well, I think it's doable. It's just a challenge.
So another aspect of tech and sleep is the thorny issue of sleep trackers. And I was actually really interested, you said somewhere in your book, I think, that we're notoriously bad at judging our own sleep, or having a, you know, a kind of sense of what's happening to ourselves when we sleep. And actually, I'm a perfect example of this, because I went through a phase a couple of years ago, I think, when I suddenly decided I wasn't getting enough sleep. So I used a sleep tracker and found, in fact, that I was sleeping very soundly for 7 hours each night, according to the sleep tracker, which I immediately abandoned and didn't use after that, and thought, oh, I obviously just have this kind of idea that I'm not sleeping. But everyone is getting very excitable about using them. What is your view on sleep trackers? Do they help in any way, or are they a really bad idea?
I have to say my view is somewhat cynical. I think that we live in an era where we want to quantify ourselves, we want to measure ourselves in, you know, in every parameter. And obviously sleep is one of those areas that has had renewed interest, and therefore there is a, you know, clear commercial interest in encouraging us to use these sleep trackers. The slight difficulty, well, there are a number of difficulties that are associated with sleep tracking. The first is that the subjective experience of sleep and objective measurement of sleep are often vastly different. So even when we use techniques like polysomnography, which is the gold standard for measuring sleep, where we measure brain waves, respiration, heart rate, a variety of other different physiological measures to measure sleep, we know that there is often a rather poor correlation between what we find on objective testing and what people report back. The second issue is that sleep trackers are not that reliable, at least not at the moment. So some are better than others. Some use more measures than others to try and calculate sleep. But by and large, whilst they're very good at telling us when we're in bed and when we're keeping still, what they're less good at is telling us how much sleep we've actually got, whether or not we've woken up during the night. And certainly for some sleep trackers on the market, what stage of sleep we're in is really no more accurate than tossing a coin. They're very, very unreliable. So for people who use sleep trackers, often they are encouraged to use sleep trackers because they have some difficulties with their sleep. And sometimes, and the situation that I've seen on many, many occasions, is that people who have a tendency towards poor sleep or a tendency towards insomnia start using these sleep trackers on a regular basis. And there are really two consequences to that. The first is it makes people fixate slightly on sleep and the process of going off to sleep. It increases their obsessionality about sleep, which in itself then creates some sleep-related anxiety and makes the problem much worse.
It's not very relaxing, is it?
It's not relaxing at all.
Worrying about sleep. Yeah.
And also, if you kind of are told in the morning by your sleep tracker, rightly or wrongly, you've had an awful night's sleep, then that can actually influence your own perception of sleep quality. You know, I describe this as the quantum physics of medicine. Essentially, whatever you're measuring, purely by the process of measurement, can alter your experience of what it is you're measuring. And the second issue is that because of that unreliability of the output that your sleep tracker is making, that can also sometimes lead you to imagine that there are problems with your sleep where there really aren't. So, you know, the other situation in which you might want to use a sleep tracker is if you think you might be a bit sleep deprived. But quite frankly, if I'm being brutally honest, you don't need a sleep tracker to tell you you're sleeping.
To tell you that, yes.
If you are waking up feeling unrefreshed, but you've had no difficulty getting off to sleep or waking up, then, you know, it's likely that if you extend your sleep opportunity, you will feel better.
Yeah. So kind of using night shift, using sleep trackers, a couple examples of maybe not altogether positive uses of tech and health and sleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you come across any kind of useful applications around sleep? I always get asked about ASMR videos and soundtracks. Kids seem to be absolutely obsessed with those at the moment and claim they can't sleep without them. And the Headspace, using an app for kind of, you know, meditation just before bed. You know, what are your views on positive applications of tech around sleep?
Well, I think that there are positive applications. I think that there is always the danger that when you introduce any tech into the bedroom, then that's the thin end of the wedge for being tempted to for that tech usage to escalate into areas which are not particularly conducive for sleep. But certainly there are a number of applications that some people find very helpful. You know, listening to podcasts that are relaxing, listening, you know, using tech for mindfulness-based relaxation therapy. You know, one of the most widely used platforms for a treatment called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is internet-based, and this is something that your NHS GP can prescribe to you. But I think that many of these apps that are useful are used during the day outside the bedroom, and then you apply what you've learned to the bedroom to avoid that temptation of escalating tech usage within the bedroom.
So do you yourself, as an expert in this area, do you have a no screen in the bedroom policy?
Well, I try to, but obviously, you know, I'm on call every so often and need to have my mobile phone next to the bed in the middle of the night. And that does tend to creep into weeks when I'm not on call. I know what I should do. Do I always do it? The honest answer is no.
Me too. I have to admit I'm a work in progress around all of this as well.
Yeah.
I found your book absolutely fascinating. My jaw was dropping at some of the stories in there. It is actually just such a good read. One of the things I wondered, because you've been working in this area such a long time, you know, these are quite kind of extreme examples in your book, but I see headlines all the time saying we're in the middle of a sleep deprivation epidemic. I think I saw a headline where the NHS said, I think it was about 3 years ago, that, you know, they felt this generation of children were the most sleep deprived. Are you seeing any trends over time in the course of your career around sleep? Do you think it's true that we're sleeping less? Our sleep quality is deteriorating?
Well, I think that there certainly are some trends. I'm not sure that I would put it in such dramatic terms. You know, look, kids have always been a bit sleep deprived. You know, in the olden days, we would be reading a book with a torch under the cover.
Yeah, with a torch.
And certainly, I think tech doesn't help because it doesn't allow people to switch off. Some of that is related to the nighttime, but some of that is also related to our usage during the day, in that it's changing the way that we think, it's changing our attention spans, and it's having, you know, really quite broad implications on how our minds develop in our youth. I think that there are some trends. For example, a bigger issue, I suspect, is the fact that we as a society are getting more and more obese.
Yeah, I noticed a little bit about sleep apnea, actually, in the book. That was really interesting. Yeah,
And I think that actually that does increase the prevalence of sleep apnea. If you look at sleep apnea prevalence charts over the last 30 or 40 years, you know, there is a really quite dramatic rise in how frequently obstructive sleep apnea presents within the population. But I think there's another aspect of this, in that we are talking much more about sleep, and people are much more aware of sleep, and so therefore they're much more likely to go and see their doctor if they have a sleep issue, which is a healthy thing. It means that actually people recognize the importance of sleep and are trying to get help. Now, whether or not that help is always available is a different matter. But the very fact that people are aware of the importance of sleep, I think, is a very good development.
I guess it's analogous to what's happened with mental health over the last few years, that we talk about it more.
Yes.
And the tendency is to think, are we suffering from more mental health conditions? But it may be, just as you say with sleep, that actually just we're more willing to talk about it.
I think there are very, very clear parallels, absolutely.
So I always end the podcast with asking you three questions about your own tech habits, guys.
Oh, dear. Okay. I'd better not let my kids listen to this.
Oh, yes. So what's the one thing you would like to say? And actually, I'm really interested. Sorry, I'm just going to go off on a tangent here. You were talking about how our habits during the day also impact on our sleep at night. So it's not, we shouldn't just be thinking about sleep as something we suddenly do at 10 o'clock at night, but we should be presumably preparing for it in our habits during the day. So I don't know if that might be connected, but what's the one thing you'd like to say to people about their kind of screen habits that might have an impact on their sleep, or just something completely unconnected to sleep?
So I think that the key thing when it comes to sleep is really just think about, as you said, the process of going to sleep doesn't start at the moment that you switch the light off and your head hits the pillow. Actually, people do need some downtime before they go to sleep. And, you know, I would encourage people to stop using gadgets, you know, for at least an hour or so before they go to bed. You know, if you're one of those lucky individuals who, no matter what they do, can always fall asleep at the drop of a hat, then don't worry about it.
But carry on using them.
Yeah. But for most of us, actually, you know, think about what you're doing in the hour or two before bed, because it does have implications on your sleep.
And have you got a tip or a habit that you haven't shared around getting a good balance with tech? What do you do? Do you have any kind of tricks that you impose on yourself that kind of helps you use it in a way that's healthy?
I think my use of tech is, if I'm being brutally honest, is not particularly healthy. Every so often I delete a whole load of apps on my phone and I switch off my notifications, and then it has a tendency to creep back. But, you know, as long as I do that every so often, then I think that at least is a move in the right direction.
What sort of apps are the ones that creep onto your phones?
Usually newspapers, and at the moment, reading newspapers is not particularly good for your mental health.
No, or sleep. Yes.
Or sleep. I What I would dearly love to do in another world is actually find my old Nokia handset from about 15 years ago, which is simply for phoning and doing nothing else. But unfortunately, work wouldn't allow that.
Yeah, there's actually a bit of a trend around those, what they call dumb phones now.
Yeah.
I had a 15-year-old boy came up to me in a school talk I did just before lockdown, showing me very proudly his Nokia phone, saying he deliberately moved to that phone because he wanted to kind of disconnect, which I thought was fascinating. And what have you learned about yourself from the way you engage with the digital world and your smartphone? Any kind of surprises along the way?
I think no surprises, but really, you know, it has made me acutely aware of the link between the way that I use tech and my own sleep. I would love to say that I'm one of those individuals who sleeps perfectly every night, but I don't. And, you know, I'm certainly very aware of the connection between my own use of tech and my own sleep.
Yeah, no, me too. Even though I've said that I love my sleep and I'm a good sleeper, I also know that if I've been on my phone for too long or too late at night, I definitely don't sleep as well. There's a definite connection between the two. I want to say really huge thank you to you, but before I do that, I want to put a little plug in for your book, The Secret World of Sleep, Journeys Through the Nocturnal Mind, which is really, really riveting. Some of the stories, as I said, were so fantastical. I mean, they read like kind of almost fairy stories. I couldn't quite believe them. But yeah, really fascinating what goes on when we sleep. It really opened my eyes. I want to recommend everybody to go out and get that.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, Tanya.
Yeah, I did. I thought Othello syndrome was really interesting. I'm not going to tell everyone what that is, but go and read the book. I loved that particular chapter. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Tanya. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of It's Complicated. If you haven't already, please do subscribe, rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. It helps other people find us and it means you get a helpful little notification when a new episode becomes available. For more about getting a healthy balance with tech, you can follow me, Tanya Goodin, or Time to Log Off on Instagram and Twitter. And both my books, Off and Stop Staring at Screens, are available on Amazon and at all good bookshops. Finally, for more information about this and other episodes in the podcast series, visit itstimetologoff.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.